This is NHL Midweek,
the podcast
on TSN1290.ca.
Here comes Ehlers speeding through the neutralized across the line. Far side from Ryan, is that for Ehlers?
A little breathing room indeed, that goal from Matthew Perreault last night, making it 5-3 for the Winnipeg Jets. They go on to a 6-3 victory after Brandon Tanev deposits one into the net with 5 seconds to go. A 6-3 final, the Jets defeating the Chicago Blackhawks last night. Good evening, Winnipeg. Good evening, Manitoba. And for all those joining us live this evening at TSN1290.ca and via the iHeartRadio app, we say good evening, universe, and welcome to NHL This Week. I'm your host, Drew Mindell, joined in studio by Sean Assor. Ezra Ginsberg is away from the program on this Wednesday evening. We have 2 hours of hockey talk for you. You can reach us here in studio. Best way to do so is via Twitter, at Legal Curve. Shawnee, good to see you on this Wednesday evening. How are you?
I'm doing very well, Drew. How are you?
I'm doing okay. I'm a little under the weather, but...
Seems to be that going around.
Yeah, right, much now. Like Sarah Orleski on the TSN 3 broadcast, battling through a little bit of a flu bug. I will do the same for the next couple hours, and then I will crawl into bed and complain about it when I get home. But that's, I guess, probably something that nobody else needs to really care about. In any event, last night it was a very good victory for the Winnipeg Jets. It got a little bit closer than they would have liked after jumping out to that commanding 4-0 lead. But whatever the case may be, the end result of a 6-3 victory against a pretty poor Chicago Blackhawks team is what Jets fans and the Jets players themselves were hoping for last evening.
I, like much of Jet Nation and those watching the TV yesterday, could not believe the start by the Chicago Blackhawks.
Yeah.
I know a sentiment echoed by every analyst we spoke to. Trevor Kidd literally said he couldn't believe his eyes at the defensive play of the Blackhawks yesterday. Mm-hmm. Jets registering 3 goals before the Blackhawks had their first shot.
Yeah.
Which came 17 and a half minutes into the first period. And Drew, just every time we talk about the Chicago Blackhawks, it seems, we're either hearing or we're reading or we're discussing how they just can't come out and get a lead.
Yeah.
How they just surrender the first, second goal, and then they got to essentially dig themselves out of a hole that their roster is not talented enough to do, despite the fact you got guys like Patrick Kane and Jonathan Toews and up-and-coming stars like Alex DeBrincat, but... I mean, that was crazy, that first period. That was almost Harlem Globetrotter-esque.
It was, I mean, the Jets were very good. But as impressive as the Jets were, the Blackhawks, to your point, Sean, were that poor. They were impressive in how poor they were. You don't see, that is a team that, you don't see very many teams in the NHL in this day and age come out that lethargically to start a game. And maybe it happens, you know, we saw it on Sunday against Philadelphia where they ran out of gas. But they came out, the Flyers came out, like, you know, on fire. Mm-hmm. And if it wasn't for Connor Hellebuck and some great saves he made, the Flyers should have been leading that game on Sunday. Mm-hmm. But last night, the Blackhawks stayed in the dressing room for the majority of the first period. And sure, you know, you battle back to make it 4-3 if you're the Blackhawks. But come on, that's nothing but window dressing.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, you talk about score effects and how, you know, the impact that has on the game. And I think that is a firm case of score effects. Because you see that when the Blackhawks make it 4-3 and the Jets begin to feel maybe like they're going to blow this, what happens? The Jets get a goal real quick. And it's 5-3. So when the Jets needed to impose their will upon the game, they were able to do so with minimal resistance from the Chicago Blackhawks. And... obviously, this isn't a roster that's built for long-term success right now. You're too top-heavy with Kane and with Keith and with Toews, And then after that, I mean, Seabrook isn't what he once was.
Those first three goals, I mean, you watch him on the ice specifically, and the Connor goal, he's literally pirouetting around the ice.
He's a fish out of water. If he watches the video, and I'm sure he will, he'll say he probably won't. Well, I mean, it's embarrassing for a guy who prides himself, or a guy who used to play at a certain level.
And who's making that much money.
Obviously. But a guy who used to play at that certain level, you know, to see him, perform in that manner is somewhat sad.
It is kind of sad.
Yeah, I mean, because you remember the Blackhawks of, I mean, not that many years ago, 4 years ago, 5 years ago, where they had epic series. They had the Western Conference Final against the Los Angeles Kings was still one of those epic playoff series that's going to stick with you. Never mind the Stanley Cups that they won, but to look at that team. And are they buying into Jeremy Colleton as a head coach? Well, clearly they're not buying into him that much if you're down 4-0 and you're down 3-0 before you even get a shot on goal. But the problems in the Blackhawks, I think, start at the general manager level with Stan Bowman and his decisions, which have been proven to be fairly rotten. And I don't know that Jeremy Colleton's the right guy for the long-term job, but I don't know that anybody's necessarily going to be able to dig these guys out of their malaise. But one thing I know for sure is that Joel Quenneville was not the one who's at fault for the Chicago Blackhawks and their woeful performance. I mean, 9-18-5 on the season, and they're 1-9 and have lost their last 8 games. And what did the stats say? They've led in the last 8 games for something like 45 seconds total.
Yeah, during that 8-game losing streak, like a 45 second lead throughout all of those games. Like, that is crazy to think about.
That's difficult to accomplish. Like, even if you're not trying, I mean, obviously they're trying, but to not have a lead, even a 1-0 lead, for longer than 45 seconds is remarkable. That is a damning testament to what the Blackhawks are going through right now. And I don't know how you solve it. I mean, do you start to consider trading Patrick Kane, Jonathan Toews, and Duncan Keith and tearing this rebuild down all the way to its bones? Because last year, that was the buy. Last year, okay, well, we're struggling and we're not a good team if we're the Blackhawks because Corey Crawford was out of the lineup. Mm-hmm. Well, Corey Crawford didn't play last night. Cam Ward did. But Corey Crawford's been in their lineup for a lot of the season, and they've still lost 8 games in a row. They're playing tonight, the Blackhawks, as they look to bounce back. But
yeah, at home to Pittsburgh?
At home to Pittsburgh, which used to be a marquee of all marquee games. The Penguins obviously playing a little bit better than they had been before. They're still not firing at all cylinders, though. But the Blackhawks look like absolutely one of the bottom feeders in the NHL. In fact, they are dead last in the NHL now.
And it's funny because eight losses in a row, but you look at their schedule, and Troy Murray was talking about this on the station last night. Pittsburgh, Winnipeg, San Jose, Nashville, Dallas, Colorado. That could snow. It's already snowballing, but that could become an avalanche real quick.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to lose 8 games in a row in regulation in the NHL. Like, this day and age in the NHL, the league is built to not let that happen. To give teams a free point for just taking a non-conference matchup into overtime.
Mm-hmm.
To lose 8 in a row in regulation is really quite the accomplishment.
And just look at some of the events that happened in the game yesterday. I mean, Nikolaj Ehlers gets stripped of the puck by Patrick Kane when it's a 4-3 game, and Kane comes in, and he rings it off the iron.
Yeah.
Maybe in the Hawks of the earlier days, that's in.
Probably.
That's Patrick Kane burying that tie game. Here we go. Completely new game. But he rings it off the post. Credit Josh Morrissey. Got the stick on the hands to take that penalty. A good penalty to take. But, Lauren Brossoit would probably want a couple of those goals back. But, I mean,
yeah, probably.
The DeBrincat one, for sure.
Yeah. The DeBrincat one, maybe the Cahoon one, but I guess you can probably live with that. Was sort of a goal mouth scramble, and the defense didn't really gather anyone up. They were sort of just covering air at that point in time.
He also spoke post game about how difficult it is to get into those games when you don't touch a puck for 17 and a half minutes.
It's for a goaltender, it's exactly what they don't want. And to his credit, the first shot the first shot he faced was actually a quality scoring opportunity. He had to make that blocker save. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, that's not an easy save to make in that instance when your team is already up 3-0. You haven't seen a shot, remarkable, through 17 and a half minutes of the game. And, I mean, the Jets were clearly the better of the two teams. I mean, there's no question about that. But just how poor the Blackhawks were is what was most impressive. I mean, Kyle Connor, that goal he scored where you mentioned it, Seabrook is turned inside out and doesn't know what he's doing, is just the entire video, the first period, the first 20 minutes of that game, 25 minutes of that game is just damning video about the state of the Chicago Blackhawks.
Even the second Kyle Connor goal where it's kind of shot from the point, tipped on net, yeah, by Mark Scheifele, and he's just by himself. Yeah. No one is even... I'm sure they're searching for the puck after a tip, but no one is aware of what's happening net front. He's literally just the only guy that knows where the puck is and buries it. And if it wasn't for Cam Ward's ridiculous glove save.
Yeah, that was an amazing save to prevent Connor. Everyone had their hats in their hand, ready to throw their hats over the ice to celebrate the hat trick.
Oh, poor Kyle.
Yeah, but you're absolutely right. I mean, when you're a team like the Blackhawks, the goal by Connor you were talking about there on the power play, the entire team is just trying to find the puck. And Connor's like, it's right here, guys. I'm going to put it in the back of the net. I have time to make a sandwich. And they're still, they're like, high stick. It was a high stick.
Yeah,
it's like,
no.
They seem like a desperate kid playing street hockey against his buddies. It's like, no, that wasn't a high stick. Like, Scheifele got it at his waist.
Yeah.
It's like, it's in the back of the net. It's going to be a goal. You guys are still don't really know what you're doing.
Yeah, we were trying to figure out what they were arguing there.
It had to have been a high stick.
Yeah, it was that. Yeah. Cam Ward's got his hands in the air. It's like, well, maybe you should focus on whoever isn't.
They were just completely discombobulated. You don't see a team that out of sorts. And, you really do wonder where the Blackhawks go from here. I mean, Friday they get their chance for revenge against the Jets, with the Jets go into Chicago on the second half of the back-to-back, and which is, somewhat funny because, of course, the Blues had their opportunity to get the revenge on the Jets last Friday, and they were successful in doing that 1-0 victory to start this homestand. Mm-hmm. And the Blackhawks have to be thinking on Friday when they play the Jets, same thing. We want revenge. We were down 4-0. We were embarrassed by this team on their home ice. Let's repay the opportunity. They're going to be coming in on the second half of back-to-back. Blackhawks playing tonight. Obviously, they won't play again until Friday when they face the Jets. But they have to be looking at that, almost relishing that quick opportunity to pay back the Winnipeg Jets on Friday night in Chicago.
Yeah, you just hope they don't overlook the Pittsburgh Penguins this evening, because Sidney Crosby will rack up many a points against you if you do.
Yeah, well, that's certainly the case. And, of course, the Jets' attention is now on tomorrow night's opponent. Mm-hmm. Two of the hottest teams in the NHL are going to do battle tomorrow night at Bell MTS Place, the Jets and the Oilers. It should be actually a terrific contest. The Oilers are playing great hockey since hiring Ken Hitchcock. When we come back, we talk about the Jets and Oilers. You're listening to NHL This Week. We are live on TSN Radio 1290.
This is NHL Midweek,
the podcast,
on TSN 1290.ca.
Here's Darnalder, shifts toward the near side at center. Cross the line, made a move, cuts toward the net, but a shot, and he scores! Darnell Nurse wins the game for Edmonton. They score four unanswered, erase a 4-1 deficit after two, and win here tonight, 5-4 in overtime.
Our buddy Paul Edmonds on the call, that from earlier this year, back on Tuesday, October 18th. The Oilers staged an impressive comeback here in Winnipeg. The Jets thought they were home and cooled until a third period comeback, and then an overtime winner from defenseman Darnell Nurse propelled the Oilers to a victory. That's back when they still had Todd McLellan as their head coach. Mm-hmm. We obviously know now Ken Hitchcock is the Oilers' head coach. And under Hitchcock, the Oilers have been playing some pretty damn good hockey. 7-2-1 in their last 10 games. Won 4 in a row. 8-2-1 in total since Hitchcock was hired. And they're now back into a playoff spot. The first wild card spot in the Western Conference. So Hitchcock, as often is the case, is a short-term answer for a team that is craving structure and craving role identification. And that's what he's done with these Oilers. Everybody now on the Oilers knows their role. Milan Lucic, who is, of course, a cautionary tale of paying a guy too much money when he's no longer that quality of an NHL player, has been told your role is to be a third line, grind it out kind of guy. You're going to play on a big, heavy line with guys like Zach Cassian. And, you know, they're having success. They're not having success on the score sheet, but that's okay. Right now, if you're the Oilers, you have a third or a fourth line of Lucic and Brodziak and Cassian, and all those guys are defensively responsible. They are going to take care of the puck in their own zone. They're not going to probably get a lot of offense at this stage in their career, so take their salaries out of the equation, but they're going to also leave an impact on you. You're going to know when you play against that line for the Oilers, and that's what Ken Hitchcock is looking for. Mm-hmm. Each of the Oilers' lines has an identity right now.
Absolutely, and I mean, it all starts on the back end, right? We've heard that here in Winnipeg for ever since Paul Maurice showed up in Winnipeg, that it starts in the defensive zone, and the offense comes based on your defense. And the Oilers are quickly learning that that is the case, and their goals against has dropped, and their offense is starting to blossom, and I mean, we're going to talk to Dave Jamieson. We're going to see if they're maybe running Connor McDavid a little too hot, if the engine is running a little too high for his minutes. But yeah,
he's playing upwards in some games of, I mean, crazy numbers for forwards. I mean, you don't see forwards playing 5-on-5 to the degree that he's playing.
No, and Ryan Nugent-Hopkins has elevated his game as of late. And apparently, Jesse Puljujärvi is understanding what's being said to him now, and he's starting to get it. So Hitchcock is getting it done, and we had Darren Dreger on earlier today, and he said it's not an easy task for him, but he's getting through to these guys, and the hard work is there, and he sees it, and he says that the Jets, and they expect this, will be in tough tomorrow when they take on the Oilers, because now you're playing a very offensively talented team that plays defense. Well, and they're getting goaltending now from both netminders.
What a novel concept that is, of course. But, I mean, that is exactly what's happening with the Oilers now, is they're a team that are no longer the laughing stock that so many of us had enjoyed watching them be. And I say that with all honesty. The Oilers, when they were a gong show, were very entertaining. Because they were so, you know, you never know what you were going to see from them. You never know what you're going to see, a home penalty kill of somewhere around 60%, which is what they were last year. But now Ken Hitchcock, I mean, I don't think Hitchcock is a long-term coach for any team anymore. I think he just wears on players too often. But right now, for an Oilers team that was clearly craving a new voice and craving somebody to organize them, and I don't know if Todd McLellan, for whatever reason, his voice had just stopped, you know, resonating in the Oilers' dressing room, or if he was still trying to pound a round peg, say Milan Lucic as a top six guy, into a square hole. But whatever it was, Ken Hitchcock has clearly laid out roles and expectations for the players on the Oilers, and as a result, they're performing much better. I mean, you look at, they've stopped sort of futzing with everything, and now futzing is a technical term, of course, but McDavid is playing with Dreisaitl, and you know, those are two tremendously talented guys, and it doesn't matter who's running shotgun with them, because those two guys can drive a line on their own, and whoever else is there can pick up the scraps. And Ryan Nugent-Hopkins is blossoming into one of the top, you know, two-way forwards in the league. Right now, any thought that the Oilers would be interested in trading Ryan Nugent-Hopkins is craziness.
Yeah, you're going to sewer all the work you've done. I mean, you're getting the depth down the middle.
Yeah.
Right now, Ryan Spooner is slotted in as your third line center, so you got a pretty decent 1-2-3 hole in the center position. Kyle Brodziak, as you were referring to, the fourth line, rounding out a competent role for that line. Milan Lucic took on Anthony Peluso, who all Jets fans remember, and Peluso looked pretty angry that they broke up that fight. What was it, last week when?
Well, he came up in that game against the Oilers on the Sunday night.
Right,
like up. Peluso playing for Calgary.
For Calgary, correct.
Had him down in Stockton playing for their AHL affiliate. They called him up for a rematch of the Battle of Alberta because the last game was fisticuffs filled. This one, less so. It was a 1-0 victory for the Oilers over the Flames. But the Battle of Alberta, at least right now, has more meaning to it and has more passion behind it. Oilers are going to be facing a little bit of adversity. Yesterday, they lost Oscar Klefblom, who'd been playing some very good defense for them.
Big time.
They lost him for weeks, not days, after he blocked the shot with his hand. So he's out of their lineup, and we do know how thin the Oilers are on the back end. So it'll be very interesting to see how they're able to handle that loss. Because with Klefbom there, you know, Kevin Gravel and Chris Weidman as their third pairing, one of those guys gets bumped out of the lineup. Now you're looking at, you know, Nurse and Larson, who are whatever, they're fine. You know, they're not a top pairing probably, but, you know, whatever. And that, but you have guys now who are playing sort of above where you want them to play. So it'll be interesting to see if the Jets can take advantage of that tomorrow when they play the Oilers at Bell MTS Place.
Yeah, and Klefbom had a couple game winners as he was picking up his play. And again, I'll cite TSN hockey insider Darren Dreger, who said that he was one of the guys that was really understanding what Hitchcock was selling to the team and was kind of relaying it to the teammates. So this is a guy that, so not only maybe an on-ice loss, but perhaps a leadership loss as well for a guy who the Oilers placed on the IR today.
Yeah, exactly right. And Mikko Koskinen has been the Oilers' goaltender of record as of late, as Cam Talbot has just hasn't been able to find his game. Koskinen, again, very good over his last nine games played. .933 save percentage and a 2.00 goals against average. This is a guy they brought over in the offseason from the KHL. Nobody really knew a lot about him, but they paid him a fairly substantial amount of money. I believe $2.5 million, if I'm not mistaken, off the top of my head. But, you know, he's finally giving the Oilers goaltending that is of the NHL quality. And so you add all those things together. 10-3-1 Koskinen now is on the entirety of the season. You add all those things together. Good goaltending. A forward group that understands its role. And defense, which is, I'm going to say, playing within itself. Mm-hmm. Not getting too carried away, trying to do too much. And a coach in Ken Hitchcock who is demanding and who is particular. And these are all the things that this team needed. Right now, the Oilers are playing good hockey, and I don't see, barring injury to McDavid or Dreisaitl or one of the other key members of this team, and to their advantage of playing in the terrible Pacific Division, I could see them being a threat all the way through the remainder of the season now.
Yeah, it's amazing what playing as a five-man unit will do for your goaltending. I mean,
sure. Well, we saw it here in Winnipeg for so long.
Exactly. I mean, when you give up a handful of less two-on-ones and odd-man rushes, it's crazy that your goaltending is all of a sudden improved. I mean, no disrespect to Mikko Koskinen or Cam Talbot, who have Mikko Koskinen playing better, of course, but it's just when you instill a defensive system, it's just, it's so funny. You're like, oh, and the goaltending's playing better. It's like, well, yeah, the goaltending's playing better because he can see the shots and he's not facing odd man rushes and breakaways and everyone's not watching Connor McDavid fly around the ice. You know, you're playing as a unit, you're working as a team, and you're doing perhaps maybe a simpler brand of hockey instead of that run and gun that you think, well, we have McDavid, we can just score a bunch of goals.
Do you think, though, Shawnee, that the time on ice that McDavid's playing, we'll ask Dave Jamieson of our sister station, TSN 1260, we'll ask him this question coming up in a couple minutes. Do you think that the ridiculous 5-on-5 minutes, the ridiculous time on ice is eventually going to catch up to him? Or do you think that he is Superman?
Well, we've seen him get injured, so we know he's not Superman.
Fair enough.
And that's just that's the thing to me. When you rely so heavily on one player, if that player goes down, I don't want to say you're screwed, but what's the mentality of the team? You can either pick yourself up and say, okay, we gotta battle back as a unit and support our team and you know, pick up the slack, but how can you pick up a slack of a guy who's playing almost half a game as your top line center?
It's hard. I mean, it's
hopefully
not
Ryan Nugent Hopkins drank a Gatorade that morning.
Well, I mean, you're never going to replace Connor McDavid. So, assuming he stays healthy, is he just going to be eventually too much wear and tear on him, or can he keep this up? I mean, do they need him to keep it up for another 50-plus games this season? Or at some point in time, do they have to throttle it back just to keep the guy, I don't know, from burning himself out?
Yeah, you know, that's a good point. Maybe when maybe when Ken Hitchcock sees maybe his system naturally starting to be implemented by the team, he doesn't have to bring out the drawing board, the X's and O's. Maybe once he sees the team doing it on their own, maybe he can pull him back a bit so he's not so heavily dependent on Connor McDavid. But Ken Hitchcock has also said that, you know, Connor McDavid is a different animal in himself. His stride and the way he moves around the ice, he exerts less energy than other guys who have to try maybe a little harder to reach top speed and to get around. So maybe McDavid exerts less energy than the average player based on the way he can skate and move around. But, I mean, what if he goes down in the end of, you know, mid-March?
Wow. I mean, if he ever goes down, it's not an issue. I mean, you know that the team is screwed.
So it is an issue.
Well, I mean, it's but there's no fooling themselves. Yeah. It's not like they're going to be able to rally. It's like the Minnesota Wild last year when they lost Ryan Suter. You know, they lose him entering the playoffs against the Jets. Well, the Wild knew they didn't have a chance against the Jets when you lose Suter. Mm-hmm. Most teams in the league, at least teams that have that clear distinction between their best player and then their other players, know that when they lose that best player, they can't pick it up. You know, so the Jets, for example, if they were to lose Mark Scheifele, it hurts dramatically, but we saw last year Blake Wheeler was able to move into the middle and they were able to keep it going while Scheifele was out of the lineup. The Oilers, it's not an issue. If you lose McDavid for any length of time, you just, you know, turn off the lights and go home. But, you know, what Ken Hitchcock's doing with this team, I was skeptical about the hire, admittedly, and I don't think he's going to be there the long-term answer there. But I think he's showing the players and showing the organization that this is what a plan looks like and why Todd McClellan, who was also a very good coach or was a good coach, at least in San Jose, wasn't able to do that. I'm not certain, but it seems like Hitchcock at least has the whole organization pointed in the right trajectory. This previous segment had been brought to you by Dr. Les Rikus and the team at Linden Market Dental Center. Dr. Rikus and his team provide modern and comprehensive dental care for the whole family. To make an appointment today, visit LindenMarketDentalCenter.com. When we come back, Dave Jamieson joins us. Dave is with our sister station, TSN 1260 in Edmonton. We talk more about the Oilers. You're listening to NHL This Week. We're live on TSN Radio 1290.
This is NHL Midweek,
the podcast
on TSN1290.ca.
Bottom of the hour, welcome back to NHL This Week. Drew Mandel and Sean Assor with you in studio. You can reach us here via Twitter, at Illegal Curve is where to do so, and our website with the latest Winnipeg Jets and Manitoba Moose news and audio is IllegalCurve.com.
Now, let's go live on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show Hotline.
Pleased to welcome back to the program our very good friend Dave Jamieson. Dave is the host of the Dave Jamieson Show on TSN 1260 in Edmonton. Dave, good evening and thanks for joining us.
Always good. Thanks, guys.
Our pleasure. Dave obviously brought you on to talk about the juggernaut Edmonton Oilers playing some damn good hockey over the last little while, particularly since Ken Hitchcock was brought aboard as head coach. Are you surprised at how well Hitch has them going since he took over behind the bench?
Oh, sure. I mean, listen, as long and successful a career as Ken Hitchcock has had, I mean, he comes in, he takes over a team that clearly was, you know, careening towards the side of the mountain, and is able to implement systems and discipline and rigor that Todd McClellan, who is a very good NHL coach, like there's not, I mean, you know, people like to look back and go, you know, he did this wrong and that wrong, and all of that doesn't matter now. But Hitch has come in, he's the new voice, and if anyone knows anything about Ken Hitchcock, he's a grinder. And he grinds and he grinds and he grinds, and so he, you know, through probably force of repetition, he's got the Oilers playing a much more structured kind of hockey. It isn't to say it's perfect yet, but I mean, the record shows that they've won more than they've lost under him, and they're doing so, you know, what's interesting is there's kind of two versions of Hitch hockey. One is the, he lets them play, and there seems to be enough upper end talent with McDavid and Draisaitl, and as we saw last night, Ryan Nugent-Hopkins. And then if they have to check and wear a team down, they're capable of doing that, and they did that against the Calgary Flames just, you know, a few nights ago. So it's an interesting thing to see play out. I don't know how long, nobody knows how long this is going to last, whether all of this is real, but right now people in Edmonton don't care. It's just, it's such a breath of fresh air from what, you know, they've largely experienced other than the season 2 years ago. You know, some of the best hockey the city's seen in over a decade.
Dave, a lot is being made about the amount of time Connor McDavid is playing, specifically 5-on-5. Can his heavy workload be maintained? And is Hitchcock and the Oilers, are they almost playing with fire running him this hard?
It's a great question, and as you know, you noted there, it's being asked a lot. I don't know if anyone knows what the upper end of human endurance is, at least with him. I don't think you want to test it necessarily, but, you know, the old line, if you've got it, smoke it. And so they're smoking it, and they're using it with McDavid. And, you know, he came back after a brief bout of the flu and played 25 minutes the first game back. He missed one and came back. So, you know, listen, none of the things that McDavid does, will do as he moves forward in his career seem that surprising anymore. And, you know, I wasn't in Edmonton when Gretzky was here. I was in Vancouver watching him beat up on the Canucks. So I can only imagine what it's like when you have a player in your city and on the team where he does something transcendent most nights. And you just, after a while, people go, yeah, he played 26 minutes last night. So, and that becomes normal. But to your point, I don't know. I'm sure they've got him on a, you know, to use a baseball term, a pitch count. They know what's optimum for him. But, you know, this is not a deep team. This is not a deep team. And that's a challenge because outside of McDavid and Draisaitl and Nugent Hopkins and Alex Chiasson's had a terrific year and he's one of the great stories in the NHL and certainly one of the great bargains, this isn't a team. They need him on the ice as often as possible.
You mentioned the lack of depth, Dave. Dave Jamieson from TSN 1260 in Edmonton is our guest on NHL This Week. And that lack of depth on the back end is going to be tested with the Oscar Klefbom injury. How do the Oilers mitigate the impact of that injury, or is that going to be one that's difficult for them to overcome?
By committee. I would suspect Darnell Nurse will be called upon to do more, play more, be better defensively. He's had kind of an interesting year. He was so good last year when the injury to Andre Sekeren, and last year neither Adam Larson or Oscar Klefbom were particularly good. So Nurse really stepped forward. He vaulted up. You know, he was their best defenseman for the bulk of last season. However, he's not been, there was a holdout this year. He arrived late, but he's been okay. I wouldn't say he's been great. But now he needs to be great because he's going to have to eat up a bunch of minutes. And I know people have talked about, you know, whether Caleb Jones will come up for Bakersfield. Look, if you're looking for the Caleb Jones of the world, who will be a very good NHL player, to be a solution right now, then you should be looking elsewhere. But, you know, Kevin Gravel's played very well. You know, I think he got about 18 minutes last night and were good minutes. They've got Jason Garrison who can come in and patch and fill. Chris Weidman is here. He hasn't seen the ice very much since coming over. But they're going to have to do it by committee. And, you know, on Klefbom, Hitchcock said it's weeks, not days. And so we can assume that that's, you know, a broken wrist or a broken fingers or whatever it's going to be. So, you know, the solution, and I can't imagine that they're going to go trade to get someone. You know, again, this is a team. Go back to the lack of depth. If you start to dig into the you know, the bones and the cartilage of this team, they don't have a lot to give up.
Yeah, Dave, just on that point, it's funny. I was just scrolling online and I saw some talk that, however valid it is, that, you know, some Oilers brass, and maybe not brass, but the fan base wants Ryan Nugent Hopkins traded for Torrey Krug. And I'm just looking at, I'm just thinking to myself, like, that is so silly because a team that lacks depth at center, this guy seems to be getting it, Evan. Why would you trade away Ryan Nugent Hopkins?
Welcome to Edmonton, where we're never really happy with anything, unless it, you know, you're talking about the early 80s Oilers. Listen, here's the thing. Ryan Nugent Hopkins had a game last night that, I mean, he was the best player the Oilers had. And Mikko Koskinen was also terrific. The Oilers were not good early, but then they got really good, and Koskinen was excellent. But all of that said, look, Ryan Nugent-Hopkins is, to my mind, the most understated player, certainly on the Oilers, and one of them in the NHL. Like, you go to a game, and he's easy to miss if you're not looking at what he does so well. So he is, you know, somebody on my show today said, this guy could be a Selke candidate if he continues to produce offensively and does what he does defensively. I mean, he's the Oilers don't have a lot of really good face-off people. He's one of them who's pretty good at that particular area of the game. But he makes smart plays. He is a terrific skater, but he doesn't have a lot of hurry. He doesn't have a lot of panic in his game. In fact, he has zero. And, you know, and Nugent Hopkins did a couple of things. One, last night on the ice, he was terrific, and he got a couple of goals. But off the ice, he dealt with the Andrew Ferentz issue or interview that came up. And it was, you know, part of the news cycle here locally yesterday because of what Ferentz said on the podcast with Elliot Friedman and Jeff Merrick. So, you know, Nugent Hopkins has been, somebody said today, he's like the Oilers' cockroach. I mean, the whole thing is burned down five times, and he continues to live. Like, he's been through all of it. All the coaches, Taylor Hall, Jordan Eberle, on and on and on. He's the last guy standing. So they put Nugent Hopkins out to speak to all of that, and he was terrific. And then he goes out on the ice, and he was terrific last night. So he is a real, because of where he was drafted, people have expectations. I mean, when we look at top draft picks, you go, well, this guy will get you, 35 goals. He'll do this. He'll do that. Nugent Hopkins is not that, but he's a whole bunch of other stuff that, you know, will not always show up on the score sheet. But if you're going to win games and you're going to win playoff series and, you know, maybe championships, you have to have a guy like Nugent Hopkins somewhere in your arsenal. And, I think he's really, for a lot of people, and he's been here forever, it was kind of a coming out, or this season has been a little bit of a coming out. You're like, wow, he is that good.
Yeah, just on that interview, you know, I wanted to touch on it briefly. What was the reaction in Edmonton? Were they surprised? Was there shock? Or were they like, yeah, we know. We remember.
Well, here's, and I think you guys can relate, obviously. We're major Canadian cities, but we're kind of small towns. Mm-hmm. And so everybody and his dog has seen an Oiler at a restaurant, at a bar, you don't have to go far to see a hockey celebrity. And so, there was a sort of a narrative that was played up that they were a young team. They didn't have a lot of veteran leadership. And so they kind of, the inmates ran the asylum for a bit, and they weren't as diligent about the work on the ice as maybe they could have been. But, look, give me $6 million a year at the age of 22. I'm not sure I would have always shown up ready to, do my homework and work as hard as possible every single day. But all of that said, Andrew Ferentz came in at a very bad time for Oilers hockey. He comes in, admittedly, as a 4-5 defenseman, and he's given the captaincy. So he's old guy in the room, and the old guy comes in, and people are like, yeah, we get it. You won a Stanley Cup with Boston, but you weren't that huge a part of that. Mm-hmm. And so, he comes in, and I don't know whether he was a good captain or a bad captain or not, but a lot of people here reacted very negatively to what Andrew Ferentz said because, A, it comes many years after the fact. B, a lot of people said, well, what did you do to change it? Which is a fair question to ask. Mm-hmm. Listen, the comments may, have been interesting in a book that Andrew Ferentz may write years down the road. But in the time, there's really, other than Nugent Hopkins, nobody's left.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
There's no, one doesn't carry over to the here and now. But because of the platform he had and because he's Andrew Ferentz and he does have a pretty good reputation and a guy, he's an interesting guy for sure. Mm-hmm. But I think a lot of people, certainly on my show and I think elsewhere, they went, from him, really?
Yeah.
Mark Messier says it, maybe we listen, but not him.
Dave Jamieson is our guest on NHL This Week. Dave is with our sister station in Edmonton, TSN 1260. We're talking about the Oilers. Dave, since Hitchcock came in, Milan Lucic sort of seems like he's playing, I'm going to say, a little bit freer in that he doesn't have the expectations necessarily on his shoulders to be an offensive player. He's playing with Brodziak and Cassian, and those aren't guys who are going to light up the score sheet. So it seems like, Hitchcock is sort of told Lucic, go play this role, go be a physical force out there, don't even worry about the offensive side of the game, and it seems to have freed him up a little bit.
you know, I love the term freed up because, look, Lucic will forever be burdened by the contract.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And I always say, don't blame the player.
No.
Never blame the player for the contract. I mean, that's, he goes in and with his agent, they, you know, the team is the one who made a decision to sign him for that money, and they went, oh, yeah, sure, that looks good to us. We'll sign it. So they did. Now, the lack of production, offensive production for Milan Lucic, you know, is troublesome. I mean, he's got, what, two goals over in the last year, I think, or whatever. It's not good. Whatever that number is, it's not good. However, I think what Hitchcock has done, and smartly, has said, look, can we just not worry about what you're paid right now, and let's worry about what you do and what you do to help this team win, and which is to go out there with that line as you've laid out, and Cassian and Brodziak, and just create disturbance, create some havoc. It doesn't mean fighting all the time. I think he's fought once against, in the Calgary game. But it's just the idea that they're kind of a nuclear deterrent. They're going to hustle. They're going to work. They're going to hit people when, you know, and in this day and age when everybody gets upset when a player gets rocked with a hit, they do a fair bit of hitting. So go out there and unsettle, disturb and annoy, and also be a deterrent so that other teams know if you're going to get, you know, fast and loose with McDavid or Dreisaitl or, you know, Nugent Hopkins, that one of those three guys, more likely Cassian and Lucic, is there if that needs to get dealt with. So, you know, I think the idea that, look, you know, Lucic, whatever we may have thought of him when he was with Boston and, you know, all of what he did there, that player may not exist anymore, but they're still, you know, a fairly useful guy, at least in Hitch's world, that he can get something done that helps the Oilers win.
Dave, quickly, what have you seen out of Jesse Puljujarvi since the coaching change?
Well, he went down to Bakersfield, and, you know, by all reports, Hitchcock asked that he be sent back up so that he could, you know, work with him. I think there's a better, you see glimpses, and you think, wow, this guy, you know, if once he's figured it out, could take over a game. And then you see a guy that kind of goes missing and at times still feels like he's still learning how to play hockey in the NHL, which, you know, is not an easy thing to do. Mm-hmm. But all of that said, I mean, I call it work in progress. And there are many people here, some of them on, you know, TSN 1260 in Edmonton, who go on and on and on about how Puljujarvi should be in the top six, and you need to just put him, you know, force feed him with the best in the world, and he'll figure it out. But, you know, at the end of the day, you earn your place, and, you know, under Hitchcock, we're led to believe he's getting more one-on-one tutelage, and that, you know, at some point it's going to pay dividends, or if it doesn't, they got to get him to a place where, you know, if they can't use him here, do they peddle him and get something that they can use?
Last one for you, Dave. Dave Jamieson of TSN 1260, our guest. It looks like Mikko Koskinen is worth the $2.5 million the Oilers have paid him when most people didn't know much about him this offseason.
Yeah, yes, he does. It looks like a deal right now.
Yeah.
You know, it does beg the question, what are the Oilers going to do moving forward? If Cam Talbot has played well, it's certainly in his last start, and, you know, Koskinen won last night. I don't know if they've announced yet who they're coming with in Winnipeg, but all that said, yeah, Koskinen now looks like smart money.
Mm-hmm.
It's still a bit of an overpay, but all of that said, that's let's give Peter Chiarelli the credit on this one. I mean, he went out and did the deal, took a lot of criticism, and now it looks like it's playing out, so he should be, you know, duly acknowledged for that. But, you know, it does raise the question, what do you want to do with Cam Talbot? If he's not your guy and you don't want to invest anymore, it would not stun me if at some point, you know, I'm sure they're entertaining offers. They have to be, given what's happening with goaltending in the NHL. Mm-hmm. And they do have Al Montoya down on the in Bakersfield, so that's an NHL-ready backup. If they think that Koskinen is their guy, at least for the foreseeable future.
Dave Jamieson covers the Oilers as part of his duties on TSN 1260. He's the host of the Dave Jamieson Show. Dave, we always appreciate your time and insight. Thanks for joining us.
Okay.
Take care, Dave. Thanks very much. When we come back, we check in with the TSN Hockey Insiders, the most recent edition of TSN Insider Trading. You're listening to NHL This Week. We are live on TSN Radio 1290.
This is NHL Midweek,
the podcast
on TSN1290.ca.
Wednesday evening, you're listening to NHL This Week. Big thanks to Dave Jamieson from TSN 1260 in Edmonton for joining us. Still to come on the program, Josh Cooper of TheAthletic.com to talk about the Los Angeles Kings. And then in the final hour, Mick Calagio of the New Bedford Standard Times. He covers the Bruins to talk about the Bruins and their season so far. This segment of the show brought to you by Frank and Mauro Zappia of Zappia Group Realty, official realtors of Illegal Curve Hockey. With 95% of your clients come via referral, it shows your commitment to honesty, integrity, and a total dedication to client satisfaction. For all your real estate needs, come shake hands with Frank and Mauro Zappia online at zappiagroup.com. Had an opportunity to have a nice chat with Frank earlier this afternoon.
Lovely.
So yeah, I saw him at the Jets game last week and a little chat today, you know, getting my full share of Frank time, which is always good quality time.
Getting that zap attacking. Quickly, Drew.
Yeah.
Blackhawks leading the Penguins. Yes. 2-1 in the first intermission, so they are going to hold that lead for at least 20 minutes.
There you go. Congratulations to the Blackhawks on finally getting a lead. The TSN Hockey Insiders sat down for another edition of Insider Trading. Here is what the insiders are hearing throughout the league.
Down one insider tonight, Bob McKenzie is out with the World Junior team in BC. Darren Dreger and Pierre Lebrun alongside tonight. Well, so far, Ken Hitchcock has worked early miracles in Edmonton, 7-2-1, his record entering play on Tuesday night. Might this be more than a short-term fix?
Well, if the Edmonton Oilers continue to win, they have a successful regular season that earns them a playoff spot. I don't think that the brass of the Oilers are going to have any choice but to extend Ken Hitchcock's contract beyond the end of this season. Now, maybe they mirror something similar to the deal that Hitchcock had formerly with the Dallas Stars, whereby if he's not the head coach of the Edmonton Oilers, then it morphs into a consultant or an advisory role. I believe that Ken Hitchcock will get an extended opportunity with the Edmonton Oilers well beyond this season.
One of the reasons Philadelphia is believed to have fired Ron Hextall is that he was too patient, was too inactive. So does Chuck Fletcher, the new guy, be really active potentially on the trade front?
He's trying to be. Our understanding is he's already talked to half the teams in the league a mere 8 days on the job as he's trying to gauge the trade market and what he can get done. And it's not just the obvious. Yes, Chuck Fletcher looking for a goalie upgrade for the Flyers that haven't been getting saves all year. But it goes beyond that. We also hear that he'd like to add a veteran defenseman for a young blue line. He'd also like to add a top nine forward. And if it's not enough, he'd like to make one of these moves before the holiday freeze on December 19th. He's not going to force it. If it's not there, it's not there before the 19th. But he'd like to make a move because he wants to add a little injection of adrenaline to a roster and tell his veteran leaders the season is not lost. The Flyers still want to compete for this year.
Well, and someone will link the Toronto Maple Leafs to the Philadelphia Flyers because there is ongoing speculation that the Toronto Maple Leafs need a power forward, and Wayne Simmons' name always pops up when you get into those type of conversations. Michael Ferland of the Carolina Hurricanes might be another consideration. I believe that if the coaching staff of the Toronto Maple Leafs were making deals, yes, they would add a power forward, but at what cost? Management, I think, is more keen on a right-shot defenseman. In a perfect scenario, the Maple Leafs would add a top pairing guy so they can move Hainsey down to the third pairing. But again, those two deals tough to make depending on the cost.
Paul Fenton took over for Chuck Fletcher last summer in Minnesota, and he's really been a wait-and-see GM in terms of wanting to take his first season with the Wild to absorb the roster, to get to know his players before he starts tweaking that roster. And my colleague at The Athletic, Michael Russo, reporting that now he's shopping the likes of a Charlie Coyle. I think what this is Paul Fenton finally starting to make more calls to see what's out there. What I can tell you is this. I believe the Boston Bruins have kicked the tires on Charlie Coyle. Not really surprising, given that the Bruins have all those injuries that they're still dealing with. You know, I don't know that this is something that's imminent, but in terms of the Wild, I think Paul Fenton may be finally starting ready to act.
Stan Bowman's never been afraid to make bold deals, but here he is with the Chicago Blackhawks entering play Tuesday, dead last in the NHL, which still looks weird. So what part of the core might be in play trade-wise?
I don't know that any of them are right now, and part of the reason for that is they're all on no moves. Now, when you talk about Patrick Kane and Jonathan Toews, I don't think those guys are ever going anywhere. Those are legacy Blackhawks players that it's really up to them. If they want to stay around and be part of this transition, I think that's the type of conversation that'll happen this summer, then they will be Hawks for life. I think the guy that's interesting to me is Duncan Keith, because he is the oldest player of that core group. He's 35. He's got a decent cap, but he's still a very good player. And when I talk to other NHL teams around the league, he's the guy that they talk about, that if he's ever in play, that they would like to talk to Chicago about. But I have no evidence to suggest that he's out there right now. I think this is an off-season discussion. What does Duncan Keith want? He's got a full no move.
Quickly, Rene Fassel's term with the IIHF will end in 2020. Already thinking to his next move?
Well, that's the speculation around the IIHF and NHL executives that Rene Fassel could, in fact, land a high-ranking job in the Continental Hockey League. That would make the KHL stronger when you look at the relationships and the contacts that Fassel has internationally.
And Bob Nicholson, of course, rumored to be one of the candidates to replace Fassel when he is done. Insider trading.
That's the latest edition of TSN's Insider Trading. Shawnee, what jumps out to me about that one is the talk about Charlie Coyle, you know, as an interesting name being potentially on the trade block from the Minnesota Wild. The Wild, obviously, you know, they're struggling. They're, you know, a fringe playoff team is how I'm going to describe them, similar to what they were last year. And they might be looking to make some changes there. Charlie Coyle's a name that would be, I would imagine, would have a fair bit of interest around the NHL, you know, in terms of, you know, names, as we're approaching about a week from now is when the holiday freeze kicks in, and people usually figure there might be some action before the holiday trade deadline, which means that as of 11:59 p.m. on December 19th, after that, there's the roster freeze until after the holidays. Charlie Coyle is an interesting name to have out there.
Yeah, not having the, a monster offensive season by any means.
Yeah.
5 goals, 10 assists in 30 games. But so 0.5 a game, half a point per game player. And what we've seen here out of Charlie Coyle in the Central Division that we've, the Jets have done plenty of battles with the Minnesota Wild is that he's a pretty versatile player.
Yeah.
Defensively responsible. He's physical. Can score.
You can play up and down your lineup.
Yep.
Just looks like a kind of guy, if they are legitimately shopping him. And of
there's
course,
for sure, you know, a market for a guy like that.
Who knows? Exactly. There's a market for a guy who can come in and you know, if he slots in on your third line, he can get you some offense from your third line. If he slots in in your second line, he can do something there as well. I just thought that name, 3.25 million one more year after this year on his contract. So not an unreasonable contract to have to take on. Can play center, can play wing. It's an interesting name I heard that has been talked about by a number of different people in the last couple weeks as a guy who might be out there, as Minnesota Wild general manager Paul Fenton sort of learns even more about his team in his first year with the franchise and decides what he needs to keep together and what he needs to maybe shake up. And that's an interesting name I found out there. When we come back, Josh Cooper is going to join us. We'll talk about the Los Angeles Kings. The Kings, of course, are in Winnipeg next Tuesday to face the Jets, and they continue to struggle, and Drew Doughty is unhappy with his team's performance. We talked to Josh about that up next. You're listening to NHL This Week. We're live on TSN Radio 1290.
This is NHL Midweek,
the podcast
on TSN1290.ca.
Hour number two of NHL This Week starts now on TSN Radio 1290. Drew Mandel, Sean Assor with you in studio. You can follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve, and our website with the latest Winnipeg Jets and Manitoba Moose news and audio is IllegalCurve.com.
Now, let's go live on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show Hotline.
From TheAthletic.com in Los Angeles, he covers the Kings, he covers the Ducks, he's one of our very closest friends. His name is Josh Cooper. Josh, good evening, and thanks for joining us.
We're best friends?
Yes! I said one of our very best friends.
One of?
Okay, fine. My very best friend, Josh Cooper.
Yes.
A belated happy Hanukkah, best friend. I didn't get your present.
I mean, Nate Thompson and Brendan Lysick both scored during Hanukkah. The Kings, two Jewish hockey players. So that's enough for your gift right there.
Do they look up at the press box and salute you when they do that?
No. What was the joke that we had? Is that like we were like how many away from a minion when we were in Winnipeg that one time? Someone took a picture of us.
Yeah, because there was me and you and Dave and Ezzy and Sean and I guess Rosen wasn't on the trip though because you were filling in for him, right?
Yeah, because it was me. Yeah, but yeah. The line was like, I don't know. I'm a bad Jew. I don't know how many a minion is.
Oh, my God, really Josh. Funny. We'll deal with that off air.
I also don't know.
Sean, come on. You went to, I mean, I know you went to Jewish school, Sean.
I blocked all that out of my memory.
Okay, well, we'll deal with this.
A little traumatic for some of us.
Yeah, we'll deal with this off air, clearly, as our audience is questioning what the hell's going on. Josh, obviously, we brought you on to talk about the Los Angeles Kings. Yeah, that was the subject matter, believe it or not. Their struggles continue, and Drew Doughty comes out last week, guns a-blazing at some of his teammates. How did Doughty's comments go over? Is he one of those guys who sort of has immunity in which to speak honestly and freely and criticize himself and his teammates?
Well, yeah. I mean, he does have the ability to do that. I mean, the problem is, and look, Drew Doughty has had an amazing career. He's won 2 Stanley Cups. One Norris Trophy for me is low. He should have more. I think that some of the voting really didn't do him justice some years. He should definitely have more than just one. Probably the best generation of this most recent era. And when you say that, and he says those, or I guess when you lay that out there and he says those comments, I think this year it rings hollow. And the reason why it rings hollow is because he also keeps making mistakes. There was the situation earlier this year. Now, granted, players are allowed to do what they want in their time off. That's not really a big issue. But after they lost to the Buffalo Sabres at home and held a team meeting and Rob Blake addressed the team, the Los Angeles Lakers and the Houston Rockets played in LeBron James' home opener with the Lakers out here. And Drew Doughty and Jonathan Quick were in attendance. And there was a video of Drew Doughty screaming at James Harden. Now, we don't know what he was saying. It looked kind of all fun and games or whatever, yelling at James Harden. That was caught on television as James Harden was walking down the hallway into the locker room. But it wasn't a good look. After that loss, it just sort of looked like you're this kind of carefree, happy-go-lucky guy where, I mean, John Stevens' job was very much in jeopardy at that point. And just he and Quick are very visibly yucking it up at the game. And I mean, look, like players are allowed to do what they want in their own free time. They could have been doing that at home watching the game on TV and we would have never known about it. You can't control where you sit at a game like that, but the optics look poor. And to me, that's just been the image of the season all year, is just the two of them just kind of sitting around and just looking like they were having a good time. Right after they had gotten completely just absolutely beat by the Buffalo Sabres and had this very sort of dramatic team meeting. So on the one hand, I mean, when he speaks, it does resonate. But on the other hand, I just think to that, and it's hard for me to take what he says 100% seriously, just because it definitely didn't show, I don't know. I mean, like, again, like it's hard for me to say just because, again, like these guys are allowed to have fun in their own free time, but it didn't look like the care factor was certainly there when you do something like that after such a bad loss and such a the meeting that ensued afterwards.
Josh, last night the Blackhawks were in Winnipeg. They lost 6-3 to the Jets. And following the game, Patrick Kane looked as dejected as a player I've seen in a post-game interview in a very long time. I'm wondering, how is Anze Kopitar handling the situation right now in Los Angeles?
So I'm not with the team at the moment. That's my coworker Lisa Dillman. Mm-hmm. But I wonder how that is breaking down, just because he is the captain. This team is basically, they turned it over to him, and it wasn't this management group, but the previous management and coaching group that did. And I don't know. I mean, he's a guy who I know is very proud. I know he's a guy who works really hard. And he was, I mean, for my money last year, he should have won the Hart Trophy. I thought he was definitely, to me, the player who presented the most value to his team of anyone in the NHL, just based on how he played. He was wonderful in how he played. I mean, just a 200-foot game all over the ice, was consistent, led the way for them. Scored big goals when it mattered, shut down opponents at key times. But this year, it's just from the get-go, it hasn't been there. And our Jordan Samuels Thomas with the Athletic, who's actually a professional player in Europe right now, who did play in the Kings and Ducks organizations over the last few years, wrote a story just breaking down Kopitar's game and basically pointing out that you can still see the speed, the strength, the skill that has made him one of the most dynamic players of his era. But the issue is just maybe he's frustrated, maybe he's forcing it too much. Hard to really tell. But that's sort of where things are right now with Kopitar.
Josh Cooper is our guest on NHL this week. We're talking about the Los Angeles Kings as they continue to struggle in the NHL's Western Conference to start this season. Josh, we know that they've already made one trade, and that was Tanner Pearson going to the Pittsburgh Penguins. So what's next for the Kings at this point in time? We've heard other names being bandied about. We've heard names like Jake Muzzin potentially being bandied about, or Alec Martinez. Is this going to be a complete rebuild with the exception of, I guess, Doughty and Kopitar as being available?
That's a really tough call, just because I don't know. On the one hand, I think that's your only option, because when you look at this team and you look at some of the contracts and the fact that, I mean, look, they were trying to hold on for a couple more years with an aging group. It's been done before. San Jose did it has been walking that tightrope for a long time and doing so successfully. I mean, they're sort of at the moment the modern day gold standard of that. Detroit, I guess, before all their guys retired, for a long time, even dating back to sort of the Steve Yzerman era. So it has been done before. I think that's what they were banking on. The problem is that with those teams, the bottom never really fell completely out. I mean, with Detroit, I mean, they made, what was it, 25, 26 straight playoff appearances? I think it was 25.
Yeah.
Up until basically, I mean, when Pavel Datsyuk ended up retiring and just everything just came to a halt there. And then with San Jose, they had that sort of mini dip and then made the Stanley Cup final the following year. So you didn't have a situation with either team where they were still looking like they were in their window, and then everything just completely went wrong and they just stopped performing at a high level, and in fact performed at a level of one of the lowest teams in the league. So I don't really know what there's really no guide to what they can do. I mean, I think that just watching this team, the fact that, I mean, I think the biggest issue, at least from the start of the year, was the fact that you just certainly, it seemed to me from where I was sitting that you had just some guys who had won a lot at a young age, had gotten big contracts based off of that, and deservedly so. And it's just any walk of life where when you get that level of assurance, when you get that level of security, you know, what do you have left to play for? What do you have left to really prove? And maybe there wasn't that much left. I mean, they're pro athletes, so there's always something, but I think that could have been an issue. And I'd written about this term complacency, that maybe they had gotten a little bit complacent. And if that's the case, then yeah, I think you do have to kind of blow it up. I mean, I think the pieces that you have to keep in this case are definitely Kopitar and Doughty, but beyond that, it probably is fair game at this point.
Josh, Ryan Miller goes down, and then the Ducks claim Chad Johnson off waivers. Can he compensate? Exactly, yeah. Big 85. Nothing he can't do. Yeah. Can he compensate that loss, or is John Gibson have an even heavier workload ahead of him now?
Well, I mean, I think that Ryan Miller's out for 6 weeks. So in my estimation, John Gibson's probably going to play every game for six straight weeks. I don't think it's going to be that bad. I mean, Chad Johnson has proven himself to be a very capable backup goaltender in this league. But, I mean, look, one of the big strengths of the Ducks was the fact that you had this sort of two-headed goaltending, so to speak, of if John Gibson couldn't go one night because he was tired or needed a break, Ryan Miller, you knew, was going to give you a really good performance, and now they don't have that. So I don't know how that's going to play out. They were very, very lucky that Chad Johnson was available on waivers essentially right when this all happened. I mean, again, he's proven himself to be one of the better backups in the league throughout his career, and there have been points where he's been a pretty good starter. I think when I worked at Yahoo Sports, I wrote a story about Chad Johnson. So I think that he's certainly capable, but no question losing Ryan Miller is really, really bad. And also the difficult thing for Ryan Miller specifically in this case was he's tied with John Van Beesbrouck for the most wins amongst a U.S.-born goaltender in NHL history. And we were all, I mean, just based on the fact that how much we like Ryan Miller as a person, to break that record. And now we're going to have to wait a little bit, and he's going to have to wait a little bit to potentially break.
Do we lose Josh?
I'm here.
There you go. Okay, you're still there. You just sort of cut out for a second there, but we got you back there.
It's this damn American power lines everywhere. And no, I'm just kidding. I don't know. I was trying to think of a joke.
It's okay. It's all good. Last question for you, Josh. We'll let you get back to your wonderful son and wife. You wrote a real interesting article for The Athletic about the effect of climate change on hockey.
Oh, boy.
So maybe,
oh
I know, I mean, you know, you're a bleeding heart liberal, but, you know, so am I. So, I'll be in the bunker with you. But, you know, maybe sort of talk about the article and, you know, what you sort of went through and how you sort of brought it all back to, you know, being related to the NHL and the game of hockey.
Okay. So first and foremost, I would like to at least point out the fact that, in my opinion, this is not a political issue. This is a science issue. And that is where I'm coming from. That's where I came from on the article.
Yeah.
And when you look at the science and you look at the fact that, yes, the Earth is warming, when you look at the fact that a very, very large majority of scientists say that humans contribute to that,
sorry, Josh, let me interrupt you for a second. How did that go over with Twitter arguments with people saying that it's...
just look at the comments of the story.
Yeah.
But seriously, like, this is what at least... I mean, I'm just saying, it is an overwhelming amount of scientists say this is a fact. So, that is how I wrote the story, was based off of that. So you jump off that point to the fact that, the global mean temperature, as a friend of mine who's a climate lawyer said to me, is increasing. When you have a situation like that, when you have a situation where, even a warm day in the middle of winter can pretty much demolish outdoor skating in a pond, it really hurts the ability to find low cost ice. And a lot of people, as an entry point to hockey, start hockey on ponds so they don't have to spend money on ice time, which is probably the biggest cost. I mean, I don't know exactly what the research says on that, but I assume ice time is the biggest cost when it comes to playing hockey, starting out hockey. So it could have a huge impact on the sport. And the NHL, to its credit, has been really good at promoting green technology, has been really good at promoting just clean policies with a lot of its team promoting offsets. And that was very much the basis of the story. Was it was part of a sort of future of hockey series that we ran at The Athletic. And I raised my hand and said, I want to do a story on how this is going to impact it. And I spoke to a lot of scientists, got a lot of clarification from a lot of scientists, did a lot of research. And I mean, look, the story's not done yet. There's a lot more that's going to go into it. There's a lot more questions about trying to make rinks more green, how we can make rinks more green. And look, I think that we can all agree on one thing, which is that clean air is nice and clean water is nice. And if the NHL and hockey rinks are doing their part because it's such an energy intensive sport, then that would be awesome. So I think they are, but we still got a ways to go.
Josh Cooper covers the Kings, he covers the Ducks, he covers the NHL for theathletic.com. He's based out of Los Angeles. Josh, appreciate your time and insight, buddy. Thanks for joining us this evening.
Just a few weeks till Colton's quest for love. Very exciting. Can't wait to talk to you all about that.
You're going to talk to Ezzy about that, because I still don't know what that is, and I frankly hope never to. Which one is that? Is that The Bachelor, Bachelorette, Bachelor in Paradise, Bachelor Winter Games?
It's a wonderful way to turn off your brain for 2 hours on a Monday and not think about things like climate change.
Well, there, fair enough. Maybe I'll get into it in that case. Thanks, Josh.
Right, take care, guys.
Take care. Right. When we come back, what are we doing when we come back, Sean? I sent you the show plan. When we come back, what are the Senators going to do with Matt Duchene and Mark Stone? You're listening to NHL This Week. We are live on TSN Radio 1290.
This is NHL Midweek,
the podcast
on TSN1290.ca.
Wednesday evening, welcome back to NHL This Week. I'm your host, Drew Mindell, joined in studio by Sean Soar, producer James DeRoschuk, doing a great job behind the board. Still to come on the program, Mick Colaggio of the New Bedford Times. He covers the Boston Bruins. He's going to join us at the bottom of the hour. Sean, a quick update from the Blackhawks and the Penguins. The Blackhawks had a 2-0 lead, and now?
2-2.
2-2. The Blackhawks do not have that 2-0 lead anymore. Good on them for briefly holding a lead, but they've given it right back.
That must have felt nice for them for that intermission.
Yeah.
And then Brian Rust scored 2 goals.
Oh, there you go. And I saw something like Brian Rust's first goals in something like 25 games or something like that.
Yeah, it looks like his second and third of the season, so yeah.
Okay, well, there you go. So good for Brian Rust, less good for
the Blackhawks
and the fans. 21 games. It's been 21 games since Brian Rust last scored a goal. Now he has 2 tonight as the Blackhawks and the Penguins continue to do battle. Other games on the out-of-town scoreboard. The Calgary Flames hold a 1-0 lead over the Philadelphia Flyers through 20 minutes. And in New York, the Golden Knights have a 3-2 lead over the Islanders almost halfway through the third period. In Ottawa, Pierre Dorion has a tough decision ahead of him. He needs to decide what he's going to do with both Matt Duchene and Mark Stone, two of their best players up front for the Ottawa Senators. Ian Mendez, who was on our program a couple weeks ago on the Saturday show and is a frequent guest of the Big Show, I believe, every Tuesday, wrote a really interesting piece about how in the past 5 years, when it comes to pending unrestricted free agents, there's only been one pending UFA to re-sign with his team for a maximum 8-year contract between December 1st and the NHL trade deadline. That player was Anze Kopitar, who signed an 8-year deal back on January 16th, 2016. So basically, if you're a pending UFA and you expect to get a max deal of 8 years, 7 years from every other team, but 8 years from the team you're currently with, everybody has had it done, has got that contract signed before December 1st. Well, looking at the calendar, it's December 12th.
Mm-hmm.
What does that say to you, Sean, about Matt Duchene and Mark Stone? I guess a two-part question. Do you think they both get max contracts? 7 years if they hit unrestricted free agency, or 8 years from the Ottawa Senators?
You would have to assume both guys, elite players in this league, proven successful players. I mean, not team success, but individual success. And you would have to assume that someone will take it's not even a risk. Someone will just commit long-term to these guys. I mean, they've both proven their worth. They've got different players, different values, but solid offensive players. Mark Stone, one of the best two-way players in the game. I mean, you'd have to assume both are going to be locked up long-term.
I would assume that both are going to go to max deals. I mean, that they're going to hit unrestricted free agency and get 7 years, especially some of the lesser players, I'm going to say, that have been given max contracts. I mean, Mark Stone, of course, he's from here in Winnipeg, mm-hmm. so people here are familiar with him, already has 15 goals this year.
Yeah, he's having a great season.
So he's on pace for close to 40 goals, which would be a career high. His previous career high was 26 goals back in 2014-15. But he's been a 60-point guy.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, this year he's on pace to shatter that. This year he's on pace to be, you know, he's over a point a game right now.
Yeah, he's over 35 points already.
Yeah, so he's having a great year on a terrible Ottawa team that really only cares about offense. I don't know if you've watched the Senators at all, but they pay no attention to defense at all. They figured if we're going to be lousy, we might as well be entertainingly lousy, and to them, I salute them for that.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, Mark Stone, you have to figure, is going to get a max deal somewhere. And Matt Duchene, who, of course, has more of a pedigree, I'm going to say, than Mark Stone. Duchene, from his time in Colorado, of course, he's off to another good season with Ottawa. 34 points. He's over a point a game as well. And this is a guy who has maxed out at 70 points back in 2013-14. So he's another guy who can get up into that 65, 70, 75-point range who will likely get a max deal. So with both of us agreeing that they're likely to get 7 or 8-year deals, and Ian Mendez's article about how nobody, with the exception of Anze Kopitar, has signed a max deal after December 1st. Is that a bad sign for Pierre Dorion? Do you think he has to take that as a sign that it's likely going to result in a trade before the trade deadline for these two guys, as opposed to getting them under contract?
I don't know if it's necessarily going to result in a trade. Maybe perhaps they weigh their options to see what's out there, to see if there's any juicier team willing to take a risk on them, or not a risk, you know what I mean, like to offer it.
But you can't go past the trade deadline and still have these guys on your team without having them under contract.
So
you can't lose them for nothing in free agency.
No, absolutely not.
So you basically have,
I mean,
you know, you more or less have 10 weeks now until the trade deadline, 10, 11 weeks until the trade deadline, that you need to get an answer or decision from these guys. You come to them with your best offer, 8 years, you know, I don't know, $64 million, $8 million a season for these guys, probably in that range, probably not, you know, somewhere in and around there, especially given the numbers they're putting up right now. You have to bring them that best offer.
Oh, you got to put forth an offer, absolutely. And if any of the two are going to stick, you think Stone, based on the draft, you know, just the organization which drafted him, and Matt Duchene saying he wants to go to a winner and he wants to play in the playoffs and have success. I'd see, if we're looking ahead, I think Mark Stone remains. I think Mark Stone will stay with the Sens, and I think Duchene will be dealt.
Well, an interesting addendum to all this, Chris Johnston of Sportsnet was talking about this earlier. Duchene, this is a quote, Duchene likes the city and team, but has played just 8 playoff games during his NHL career, so not a lot of playoff experience. Approaching age 28, he wants to be part of a winner. He will also be influenced to some extent by the future of Mark Stone, Ottawa's other pending UFA forward who can't sign an extension before January 1st. That's the asterisk, that's the Stone. I'll get back to that in a second. If Stone stays, there's a better chance that Duchene stays too. So it's almost, to some extent, he's saying that they're a bit of a package deal. Now, the reason Stone can't sign an extension until January 1st is he's currently playing on a one-year contract.
Right.
And when you're on a one-year contract, you can't sign a contract extension until January 1st hits. So the Mark Stone factor is sort of, you can talk about a contract, you just can't sign it. So I would hope that they would be having these conversations with Stone and Duchene.
You assume those conversations are being had.
Yeah, just behind the scenes. You can't officially sign the documents, but there's nothing preventing Pierre Dorion from talking to Mark Stone's agent. There's no rule against that.
Yeah, and you have to be, I'm sure they're weighing all their options right now as that deadline approaches.
Let me ask you this quickly, because we have Mick Colaggio coming on. Would you sign it? Knowing what you know about the Senators organization, would you sign an 8-year contract with both of the with the Senators, or would you wait till free agency, see what you can get on a 7-year deal in free agency?
You kind of have to assume that they would see what's out there. Personally, I would. I mean, you look at the Sens roster, you talk about their lack of defense. I mean, if you're Mark Stone, you don't want to waste your talent away in a team that can't hold it down defensively, nor Matt Duchene. So that's a tough one. I have to say, I'm going to go, yeah, you test it. You test the market.
I tend to agree with you. And the roster is only part of my thinking. I don't know
ownership.
That I want to, ownership. I don't think I want to be in that situation with ownership that is as volatile as Eugene Melnyk has proven to be.
And the relationship with the fans and the arena. There are a lot of factors.
There's a lot of things that I'm saying to myself, why do I want to be a part of this? I'm going to go get 7 years and, you know, I'll go get my 7 years and my $8 million or my $8.5 million per season from a better organization.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a real handicap, I think, that Pierre Dorion and the Senators management is having to work through right now.
Also, when Pierre Dorion wears, or sorry, Eugene Melnyk, when he wears his Ottawa Senators jersey, the guy's got to get a new jersey. Stop wearing the old jersey.
You think he could probably pilfer one from the team store at some point in time.
You'd hope.
When we come back, Mick Colaggio is going to join us. Mick covers the Boston Bruins for the New Bedford Standard Times. We'll talk about the Bruins and what's going on in Beantown up next. You're listening to NHL This Week. We are live on TSN Radio 1290.
This is NHL Midweek,
the podcast
on TSN 1290.ca.
Little past bottom of the hour. Welcome back to NHL This Week. This segment of the show is brought to you by Keener Jerseys, located at 982 Portage Avenue. At Keener Jerseys, making a better jersey is what they do. To have your jersey personalized or to order new jerseys for your rec team, go to KeenerJerseys.com. Keener Jerseys, they're on your team.
Now, let's go live on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show Hotline.
Alongside Sean Assor, I'm your host, Drew Mindell. We're pleased to welcome back to the program Mick Colaggio. Mick is with the New Bedford Standard Times. He covers the Boston Bruins. Mick, good evening, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Drew, for having me.
Our pleasure, Mick. Always appreciate you giving us your time. Talk about the Bruins. Bruins sort of just churning along in there in the Eastern Conference, in the Atlantic Division. Maybe a little bit under the radar so far this year, but they're, you know, solidly in a playoff spot. 17-10-4. Pretty impressive considering some of the injuries the Bruins have run into so far this season.
Well, if you notice, they just grinded out a few wins here. Before that, they had dropped a few, and they hadn't lost a few in a row all season long. And the last of those actually put them down to a point where they had played twice as many games as they had won. And as you know, during the shootout era, you got to win more than half your games in order to fairly expect that you'll make the playoffs.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's very rare that a team wins fewer than 42 and makes the playoffs, assuming an average number of loser points. Well, the Bruins kind of hit the skids a little bit there. It kind of caught up to them that they've been playing without Bergeron, playing without Chara, playing without Kevin Miller. They were playing for a long time without Charlie McAvoy, who was back. David Krejci sustained some really serious body checks in straight games, that one of them knocked his teeth out of his head, and the one after that he was okay. And so the hits keep on coming. David Backes skating the face last night. So it doesn't, the drama hasn't stopped with this team, but somehow they keep on hanging around. They got great structure, and the kids are really starting to toughen up and step up. And and I think that's really a big part of it for this team right now, is that they know that half their team is still of entry-level ilk. And in order for them to be a better playoff team than they were last year, those players have to be harder on the puck, win more pucks, win more battles. And the defensive part of the game has come surprisingly easy for all of those guys. But the battle level is, as you know, can take years before a guy, you know, plays like he's 28. When he's 21, that's pretty rare. And these guys, and most of them are about 21. So I think that that's the hard part for the Bruins, but their best players have been terrific.
Mick, one guy on the Bruins roster who I have a boatload of respect for is David Krejci. He just played his 800th career game. How's his season been thus far, and how's he looking as a replacement for Patrice Bergeron on that top line as Bergeron heals up?
Well, I think that when Jake DeBrusque went out of the lineup, and it's suspected that he's dealing with a concussion now, but it's not yet determined. He had taken a puck to the back of the head, and he played a few more games, and then he went out of the lineup. Now, without needing Krejci to carry him, Bruce Cassidy decided to place him between Bergeron and Marchand. I mean, between Marchand and Pasternak, who had been using Colby Cave, who is a very much a Riley Nash lookalike and somewhat of a play-alike, albeit a left-handed shot. And Cave doesn't really add to the offense for those guys, but he's got good structure and good battle. And he's, can really, handle the defensive aspects of that job. So Butch decides to do this with Krejci, and it went crazy. They're about 5-minute bracket in the second period of that game last night, and they completely turned around what was looking like a flat performance for the team. They're okay. They weren't great, but they were just losing. And those guys just turned them lights out. And it changed the whole game around. It was very dynamic. And now Krejci himself, excuse me, I think he's been excellent all year long. The problem is, he's been, he hasn't had wings. Finally, he's got DeBrusque last year, and he still needs a right wing. David Krejci's always been a terrific playmaker who could clean up on the chaos that speed and or physicality create on his wings. It used to be Lucic and Nathan Horton. Then it was Lucic and Jerome Iginla for 1 year. And ever since then, it's been a revolving door. And finally, he got DeBrusque last year, who got some traction. And while Jake has had, you know, a little bit ups and downs this year, he's competed hard, and now he's out injured. So now Krejci gets to play with the elites, and look what happened. David Krejci has not fallen off nearly as much as been rumored. It's really what's going on around him. He's the kind of player who makes great things happen when he has the equipment to do it.
Mick Colaggio is our guest on NHL This Week. We're talking about the Boston Bruins. Mick covers the Bruins for the Standard Times in New Bedford, Massachusetts. Mick, one of the great stories, I think, this season that really is going under the radar is the play of Yaroslav Halak. .930 save percentage, a 2.3 goals against average. It's not like Tuukka Rask has been poor this year, but where would the Bruins be without the performance of Yaroslav Halak?
Well, if you look at the first dozen or so games, they would have been in big trouble because Tuukka had yet to find it, and Halak was lights out. He was Vezina level as he started the season. You could even see the optics with his game were tremendous. The way he looked so calm and so ready to just decide how the shooter was going to have to play him. And he was in charge, and his game, he was so on top of his game. What's happened since then, after Rask's much-publicized personal break for a few days, Rask came back and hit the ground running. And Halak, just before that, his level kind of dropped. So right now, both guys are kind of in between their best and their worst, which is actually, by their standards, very good. So the Bruins are getting the goaltending. Has it been spectacular of late? Not really, but it's been good. And it's been, they're giving their team a chance to win, and that's what you need on a nightly basis. And when they made a decision to let Anton Khudobin go after he had a very solid season as Rask backup, clearly paying a little more to get a guy like Halak, a journeyman starter, you're basically saying, look, this is a meritocracy from here on out. If Halak outplays Rask, Halak's going to play. And that's the way it is, and I think that brings out better in Tuukka. And at the very least, both guys are more rested after the long haul as they're both getting into their 30s now.
Mick, longtime NHLer and now strength and conditioning coach Gary Roberts up here in Canada had a hilarious line. He said that he would love to get back into the NHL because he would want a few shifts on the ice with Brad Marchand. Something tells me Marchand would relish that opportunity.
There's a lot of guys who would like to be on the ice with Brad Marchand in his uniform and against him. He's a unique player because he's one of the most powerful skaters in the league. Mm-hmm. He may not match McDavid's burst of speed, but what he does have is that Sidney Crosby, Ray Bourque, one stride and it changes what zone he's in. And he can just, and his stamina level is incredible. Brad Marchand can go behind his own net. I saw this the other night. He went behind his net in the game Saturday night, fought for a puck, stole the puck, moved it up the boards. It got lost by his teammate. He follows up and makes sure that puck gets out of his zone. Then he pursued down the other end and bothered the forecheck. And I'm thinking, I would have like not had a lung left in my body at this point. But this guy, you know, is such a competitive player. And then he goes and he makes these bonehead plays. And I don't just mean the cheap shot stuff. I mean, he'll like toe drag and do things, pond hockey moves and stuff. And like four in a row will fail miserably. And you'll say, what is he doing out there? And then he'll make the play that wins the game right after that. He's just that kind of player right now. He can take over a game. It's incredible to see him play right now. It's hard to know what you're going to get, but it's going to be worth watching.
Mick Colaggio is our guest on NHL this week. Mick covers the Boston Bruins for the New Bedford Standard Times. Mick, you look at this Bruins roster, and you know who the stars on this team are, especially up front. You know who's driving this team. The Marchands, the Pasternaks, the Krejcis, the Backuses, Bergeron when he's healthy. Of that sort of next wave of players, the younger guys who are sort of just finding their role with the team or maybe getting their first consistent taste of NHL action, who's going to be an offensive player among that second group?
Generationally speaking, McAvoy is the one that you're looking at down on the back end to drive your transition game mm-hmm. and to be a two-way monster. Brandon Carlo, you're looking at as your shutdown future. Brandon Carlo's playing a really good brand of hockey right now. And these are both right shot defensemen who made Adam McQuaid expendable because you have Kevin Miller as well, who's now out. So there's Stephen Kemper's getting in the game right now. Your left side is a tricky one because John Moore's on a 5-year deal and he's in the prime of his career. And is he really a top four defenseman? Well, you know, if the game is fast-paced and there's a lot of skating and shooting involved, yeah. If there's a lot of hitting involved, not so much. Torrey Krug, odd duck, you know, another guy who's in the prime of his career right now, who's a dynamic player offensively. Defensively, he's actually a great competitor, and he's an orthodox player defensively. The problem is that he has heavy legs and he doesn't have the foot speed to deal with the transition kinds of plays that happen by the elites. So you're getting paid. He's got the highest salary on the blue line right now, and he's the guy who you really don't want in a top four position against the playoff team. So the Bruins are a little dysfunctional back there. They're going to have to get that figured out over the next couple of years while they're maturing their group. Up front, they have several hopefuls. They're hoping this kid in juniors, Jack Stadnica, is going to be a dynamic player for them. But he clearly is just a bony kid right now. He's not quite ready for the pros. Jacob Forsbacka Carlson from Boston University, he is now starting to figure it out a little bit. And this kid has got some excellent passing and vision talent. So I'm really not sure what he's going to be. His future may be Krejci-esque, but it's come slower for him. Krejci lit it up in the American League in 06-07 and then, you know, hit the ground running in the NHL. And this kid here, it's a little different for him. He's good, though. And so DeBrusque is the one who's making impact as a forward right now, who they're looking at as a goal scorer. Anders Bjork, they had high hopes for him. He's in the minors now trying to gain back his confidence because injuries have interrupted his career, and he's never really found a flow. And I think he was such a dominant player when he played at Notre Dame that it really became difficult for him to translate that game. He was Marchand in Notre Dame's games. He can't come and be that in the NHL. So yes, it's going to take him longer to figure it out, but I think it's there for him if he can figure it out. And I've been just some of these things, a lot of these kids are going to take time for the Bruins. And right now, it's a little, and Trent Frederick, another centerman, pretty young, playing in the AHL. They got some guys they like, but it's going to take them a while before they can be impactful for the NHL team. All the nucleus is getting older and older, and that's their quandary right now.
Mick, last night versus the Coyotes, David Pastrnak made an unbelievable slap pass to Brad Marchand on the back door for a tap-in for the 3-2 goal. I was sitting on the couch watching it and just had to shake my head thinking, that is skill beyond something I'll even ever understand. Does Pastrnak get the respect, you know, tied for second in the NHL in goals, does he get the respect he deserves as a playmaker?
I think from within the tight circles around the Bruins, yes. Around the league, I don't really know. I can only say that I think that Pastrnak is so much a work in progress that even though he has his spectacular moments and he is a productive player, I think that we don't yet have really seen what he's going to ultimately become because he reminds me a little bit of Jaromír Jágr in this one regard. Jágr started out as a finesse playmaker and a speedy guy who ultimately became just a truck of a puck protector. And I don't think Pasternak will ever be as big on the puck as Yager was, but I do think that that is really going to be the direction of his game. I think that ultimately his game will be more physical, and he will be able to do more with his body physically than what he will do speed-wise, even though he's got pretty good speed, and he's got a real imagination and some original moves, and he enjoys the game. He loves playing, and that's such a big part of it. I was talking to David Conte, the longtime scout for the Devils, who's now working again after being with Vegas, working again with Lou Lamoriello with the Islanders, and he talked about certain guys who played the game and were really great because they loved it so much, and he said Wayne Gretzky was one of those guys. I look at Pasternak, and I say, this guy loves the fans. He loves the moment. He loves the rink. He loves playing. I think that's one of the reasons why he's going to just keep on getting better. And I'm pretty excited to see what the finished product will be, but we may not know what that is for 5 years.
Mick Colaggio covers the Boston Bruins for the New Bedford Standard Times. Mick, always appreciate your time and insight. Thanks so much for joining us this evening.
Thanks for having me on. I love talking about hockey, guys.
Take care, Mick. We'll do it again real soon. When we come back, we discuss the St. Louis Blues. When they're not fighting on the ice, they're fighting with each other in practice. Not some great times in St. Louis. We talk about that next. One final segment to come. You're listening to NHL This Week. We're live on TSN Radio 1290.
This is NHL Midweek,
the podcast
on TSN1290.ca.
Oh, not the Panthers yet.
Oh, oh! Deflection of the net!
Seen this. I saw it in a video I wanted to see if a goal like that would count. The referee is very much part of the game, and that goal would count. I've never seen this.
That was from last night. So the goal didn't count. Got to make that clear. You're not allowed to score a goal after you dump it. If you dump it into the corner, it deflects off of the referee, injuring the referee, and somehow, I don't know the physics behind it, because I'm not sure how it was possible, ricochets into the net from the exact corner of the boards. But that's what happened last night in the Blues-Panthers game. Robert Bertuzzo steps over the red line and just dumps the puck in, as you see happen countless number of times in an NHL game.
I just watched it right now on the screen.
There you go. It deflects. So his dump-in goes right off of Tim Peel, the official who's standing in the corner. And he's standing behind the goal line, like, you know, out of the way where you see refs stand all the time. It deflects off Tim Peel and somehow sneaks in between Roberto Luongo and the goalpost and goes in the net. The physics of it are impossible. They could try that for a million times and never be able to pull it off again. It doesn't count because a goal is not allowed to deflect immediately in off of the official without it being contacted by another player. But if you haven't seen the video, you got to check it out. It's one of the most unbelievable videos you're going to see. And Tim Peel, poor guy, takes the puck in what does not appear to be a friendly area. It looks like the midsection. And then after he's like, you know, he's staggering a little bit and he falls backwards into the boards, because he's hurt from taking the puck in the midsection, and then the puck ends up in the net. I mean, what are the odds? The odds are unfathomable. Nope. To have that play occur between the Blues and the Panthers last night. It ends up with the Blues winning the game. Ultimately, the Panthers fall to the Blues, but, I mean, the game is secondary to the ridiculousness of that sequence of events.
Listen, I'm no physics expert. Literally, no. The only physics formula I remember is distance equals velocity over time, and I've probably gotten that wrong. And I'm trying to figure out.
D equals V over T. That sounds right, yeah.
So I'm trying to do that.
Yeah. E equals MC squared also.
That can't.
Do you remember what gravity is?
Do you
remember the speed of gravity? Something falling?
I don't remember the speed.
9.8 per meters per second squared, if I recall correctly.
Well, that does actually sound familiar.
Yeah, I think that if I remember my grade 10 physics class, 9.8 per meters per second squared.
Well, there was about 9.8 meters per second squared of time when the puck hits Tim Peel, and Roberto Luongo is probably laughing or concerned as he watches the puck kind of roll in. I wonder if Luongo knew the rules.
It's a good question.
Because he's kind of staring at the ref. looking around going,
You know, I'm willing to bet he doesn't. I didn't.
I don't think anyone.
The broadcasters didn't clearly.
Poor Tim Peel.
Poor Tim Peel. I'm glad somebody consulted. I'm glad the officials knew the rules. But, I mean, if I'm a player, you probably don't know that rule because it's not like it's something that comes up in a game on a regular basis.
So now Robert Bortuzzo is so angry with the situation in St. Louis that he's fighting not only his own teammates, yeah, but now he's taking it out on the refs also.
Well, I'm glad that the Blues won because earlier in the week, Zach Sanford and Robert Bortuzzo got into a fight in practice. You know, after they had a good stick swinging incident, and eventually they drop the gloves, and Craig Conroy comes in and splits it up, and everything else. Craig Berube, I keep calling him Craig Conroy. I did that on Saturday's show also. I'll be okay.
Yeah, I'll be fine.
Yeah, but bad times for the Blues. Do you think a fight like that can galvanize a team, or is it just one of those things that happens when guys get frustrated?
Was it Patrick Maroon that said he likes to see that? Yeah, and it fires him up, and yeah, it can galvanize a team. And listen, you can say whatever you want. These are we usually make a bigger deal of this than I think it actually is. I think these guys kind of shrug these incidents off, but I just feel so bad for Tim Peel's midsection. That is so painful to look at. And he's taking it in stride. Yeah. He's buddies with Rick Ralph. They text each other. He texted him today holding the puck with a tape. My first NHL goal.
There you go.
So he's taking it in stride.
He's got a good attitude. That's it for this Wednesday edition of NHL This Week. A big thank you to all of our guests, Dave Jamieson, Josh Cooper, and Mick Colaggio. In case you missed any of the show, it's available for download on tsn1290.ca, on illegalcurve.com, or subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. Get it sent automatically to you each and every week. Big thank you to our sponsors, Keener Jerseys, Zappia Group Realty, Bernstein's Deli, Linden Market Dental Center, and Rumors Restaurant and Comedy Club. Support these fine local businesses because they support Illegal Curve Hockey. Big props to producer James DeRoschak doing a great job behind the board. For Sean Asor, I'm your host, Drew Mandel. Until Saturday at 9 a.m., we wish you good night and good luck, and thanks for listening to TSN Radio 1290.